thank you for inviting me here today. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Wenzer. I'm currently finishing my PhD at MIT. And so I'm excited to be telling you about some work that I did recently looking at the formation of the first stars amidst decaying and annihilating dark matter. So this is work I did together with Hongwen Liu, who unfortunately couldn't make it to this workshop, as well as Julian and my advisor, Tracy Slatier. So I'll be looking at pretty similar systems to what Aaron and Flip described earlier. They pretty much gave half my talk at this point, so hopefully a lot of this will be review, but I'm gonna repeat it all anyways. So given our discussions yesterday, hopefully I won't have to put in too much effort to convince you as to why these are two important considerations in searching for dark matter. So two of the guiding principles that I've been looking to throughout my PhD have been what are the most general signatures of dark matter that we can look for in astrophysical and cosmological observables, so namely exotic energy injection, which is what I'll be talking about today, and then also what is new data coming out that we can leverage to look for these signatures. And so the reason that we are all here today is because there's a lot of really cool high redshift data coming out from, for example, 21 centimeter cosmology, as well as infrared telescopes like James Webb. And so these are going to give us our very first look into the environments in which the first stars and galaxies formed, as well as potentially the first black holes. And so I think it's interesting to then ask, how can exotic energy injection or other signatures of different dark matter microphysics thus imprint on the formation of these very first objects? So eventually, when we're studying the collapse of a halo into stars, this eventually becomes a complicated and rather highly nonlinear process. So this is a process that eventually we have to tackle with tools such as hydrodynamical simulations. However, because these simulations are quite computationally expensive, we can't run them over like every single dark matter model that might be of interest. So this is where our study comes in. One of our primary motivations was to pave the way eventually for things like simulations to study how dark matter affects star formation, but by identifying the models which have the biggest impact and are therefore most interesting to study with simulations. Okay, so that's the motivation. So let me start by telling you a little bit about what I mean by exotic energy injection and what examples I'm going to be focusing on throughout this talk. So when I say exotic energy injection, I'm referring to energy that gets injected into electromagnetic observables, but by processes that aren't readily explained by, for example, the lambda CDM standard cosmological model or the standard model of particle physics. So for example, throughout this talk, I will be focusing on the example of decaying dark matter, since that's the example that our results are most applicable to. But exotic energy injection could also refer to annihilating dark matter, which we've already heard a fair bit about, as well as evaporation or accretion onto primordial black holes. So our studies also have implications for some of these models. Okay, so this is a question I often get from the particle physicists. What kind of model or what kind of Lagrangian are you looking at? And so again, the nice thing about exotic energy injection is we can study it in a relatively model-independent way. So if I want to know how this affects the universe, I don't need to specify a particular particle physics model. As long as you tell me the redshift dependence at which energy is being injected into our universe, and you tell me the spectrum of primary particles resulting from, say, a decay or annihilation, I can tell you what this does to our universe. So for example, for decaying dark matter, if you tell me what the dark matter mass is, that specifies usually the spectrum of primary particles you get. If you tell me it's decay lifetime, that determines the rate of these interactions. And then I will mostly focus on decay to electrons and positrons or to photons, since even if you decay to heavier final states, usually the cooling cascades for those particles give you lots of electrons and photons, so you can understand those results in terms of these two channels. Okay, so let's break down how exactly exotic energy injection is going to affect different observables throughout our universe. And so to do this, we're going to have to track quite a few different processes. So let me start with a simple example of a single dark matter particle. Let's call it chi. Say it decays to a pair of electrons and positrons. So depending on what the mass of this dark matter particle is, these electrons and positrons could have a very high kinetic energy and then go on to deposit that energy in a number of different ways. So for example, they could thermalize as charged particles in our universe, thus depositing that energy as heat. Alternatively, these electrons and positrons could collide with atoms in our universe, primarily hydrogen or helium, thus exciting the atoms, And then when the atoms de-excite, they're going to emit line photons that we can then try to search for on top of background radiation. Another thing that these electrons could do is they could inverse Compton scatter against CMB photons, and thus these photons get scattered to relatively high energies. But and so we could also search for this as a distortion to the spectrum of the microwave background. But that's not the end of the picture for these photons. If they have a high enough energy, they could go on to do things like photoionize the same atoms that we found, hydrogen or helium. Ionizations could also be caused by collisions with the primary electrons and positrons, and then the secondary electrons resulting from these ionizations could undergo any of these processes all over again. So as you can see, if we want to track the effect of exotic energy injection on quantities such as the gas temperature or the ionization fraction of our universe, as well as the spectrum of background radiation, it's fairly non-trivial to track these cascades in enough detail to say anything accurate about what the effect on these quantities is. Question?
Maybe it's a naive question, but this is a rare event, right?
This is a what?
The probability of this event is...
This decay.
Yeah, this decay is not high, right?
It's, yeah, the lifetimes we look at are usually quite quite long. So only a small, a tiny fraction of the dark matter decays, if that's what you mean.
Does amplify this process in order to see the observables related to the excited helium, for instance?
Sorry, you're asking like how is it possible to see such a signal?
Is it possible? Yeah, the possibility of it is not that much.
Yeah, so the way I think about it is if you consider how much energy density there is in dark matter compared to baryons, there's 5 times as much energy density in dark matter, which means that per hydrogen atom in our universe, there's about 5 GeV of energy in dark matter, right?
So because of that energy, the possibility of low possibility is compensated by the high.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as I was saying, it's pretty non-trivial to track these cascades. Luckily for you all, tools have been developed to do exactly this kind of calculation. So the tool that I have been involved with developing, as well as Yutian, who is going to tell us a bit more about other developments this afternoon. So the tool we've been working on is called Dark History. This is a Python-based code package that you can download at this link. And so in its original form, what Dark History did was it calculated the global temperature and ionization history of our universe, while self-consistently including models for exotic energy injection. And so as of March of this year, we recently released some major upgrades to Dark History, where we made some improvements such that you could also track the evolution of the background of radiation. So for this talk, I'm not going to go into any details about what those upgrades entailed, but I'm happy to talk about it later, and you can also find the details at these archive numbers here. Okay, so that's exotic energy injection. And so now let's dive into the process of early star formation and eventually how exotic energy injection is going to feed into these processes. So the typical way that we think about stars forming is you have this, you start out with this gas cloud, it's able to cool by some mechanism in the universe today, that's usually through the help of metals. And then this gas is able to collapse and eventually collapse rapidly, fragment, and then become dense enough to form stars. However, in the early universe, before stars have formed, there's sort of by definition no metals in the universe, so we have to cool via this molecular hydrogen. And so in the last two talks, you've already seen these reactions. So I don't have to explain too much about what this all entails. But the important thing to note is, as Aaron and Flip said, these reaction rates can be affected by quantities such as the ionization fraction, since you need electrons to catalyze molecular hydrogen. But they can also be affected by the gas temperature, since the temperature controls the rate of these reactions. And then there's also the effect of radiation, which we have, again, talked about a little bit already, since radiation at the right energies can either cause photodetachment of this intermediate H- state that you need to form molecular hydrogen, or it can even photodissociate the H2 itself. So since these three quantities are important for the formation of molecular hydrogen, then I think it's important to ask, how can exotic energy injection impact the formation of the very first stars in our universe, since we're starting to get into a glimpse of what that star formation history looked like? Okay, so again, we're going to use a relatively simple method to treat these halos, since in principle, it's star formation is actually quite a messy process. So we're going to start by treating our gas, the gas in these halos, as a spherical top hat, so just balls of uniform density. And so the first thing that has to happen is this overdensity has to collapse and virialize so that we get this little protostellar halo. And so that's going to be some balance of the kinetic energy of the gas working against the gravity. And then after the gas virializes, in order for the baryons to continue collapsing and eventually become stars, there must be some way for them to further dissipate their kinetic energy, right? So this is going to be a competing process. There's going to be competing effects between processes that heat the gas, such as exotic heating, versus the molecular hydrogen cooling. And so typically, for smaller halos, these things tend to be less efficient at cooling. So what happens is, as they start to collapse, they collapse, but eventually, because they're not very efficient at this cooling, they become pressure supported, and you get this blob of gas that doesn't fragment and form stars. Maybe it becomes a direct collapse black hole. But then if you look at larger halos, for larger halos, we find that this cooling tends to be much more efficient. So you can get this runaway collapse and get this fragmentation that gives us the first stars in our universe. So what that means is before I get to the next part, let me tell you a little bit about how exactly we evolved the halos in our study. So the quantities characterizing the halo that we're going to track are the free electron fraction of the gas in the halo, the molecular hydrogen abundance, the gas temperature, as well as the density. So these are the quantities that we evolve. As I said, we start by treating them as a top hat halo and evolve these until we say the halo is virialized. So we say this is the case either once the density reaches the density that we would expect for a virialized halo, or the temperature reaches gas temperature reaches the virial temperature for a halo at this mass. And then after that, we hold the density fixed and continue to evolve the other quantities in order to see right after virialization how quickly are these halos cooling. Because if they cool faster than a certain condition, we can say this gas is probably undergoing basically free fall, and so the gas is going to fragment and become stars. So the condition that we use is we ask that the temperature drop substantially within a Hubble time. So during matter domination, you can show that this approximately gives you this condition here. So we need the temperature. So this eta here is a coefficient of 2/3. You can derive that's the coefficient you would expect during matter domination. And so we ask that once the redshift drops by a factor of about 2/3, we ask that the temperature also drop by 2/3. So that's represented by these lines here. After the halo virializes, we need the temperature to cross back through this lower line in order to say this thing is probably cooling fast enough that we can say probably star formation is happening within these halos.
Your condition, it's just the drop, or there's an additional condition?
It's just the drop. So once it hits this top line, we say it's virialized, and then once it if it crosses back through down this bottom line, then the temperature has dropped sufficiently quickly. But if, for example, the cooling was so slow that it didn't pass through this bottom line and kind of just zoomed through here.
So I should ignore any intersection with the other bottom curves.
Those are just other quantities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And essentially, that's where you stop evolving in some sense.
Say again?
Do you keep evolving afterwards and use information, or do you just say star formation turns on, I'm done?
Star formation turns on, I'm done. Yeah, we evolve it past here, but I don't think you can trust these quantities too far past this because the density doesn't really stay fixed. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Good. Okay. So that's how we track the halo evolution in this study. Okay. And so now how are we going to throw exotic energy injection into this picture? So as I mentioned before, dark history tracks how energy is deposited into heat, ionization, and radiation globally. So the key assumption that we make in our study is that the energy deposition per baryon in the halo is the same as what you would get in the IGM. And so this is how we include energy deposition into the evolution of these different quantities for the gas in the halo. So we justified this by following certain simplified cascades. for decaying dark matter, and found that this assumption is likely good for a large range of masses that we studied. The exception is maybe around like 10 to 100 MeV mass dark matter. This assumption doesn't hold quite as well. But for the rest of the range, we think this is fairly justified. Okay. So with all this in mind, we can now ask what is the critical halo mass above which we expect most halos to collapse and become stars, and then ask how is this halo mass affected by exotic energy injection. So for example, this is the critical mass threshold that we derive from a standard cosmology in dark history. In other words, we're not including any exotic energy injection yet. So this is halo mass, and this threshold is a function of redshift. And so once we throw in exotic energy injection, what happens to the threshold? Could it be raised and make it harder for stars to form, thus delaying the onset of star formation and perhaps leading to the formation of other interesting compact objects? Or could you, in fact, lower this threshold for collapse and thus accelerate the onset of star formation? So we can examine the effects that I've talked about one by one. So again, here is what the threshold looks like for no exotic energy injections. And now let's see what happens if we throw in this particular dark matter model, which is for dark matter decaying to E plus E minus at a mass of around 200 MeV and a lifetime that's about 10 to the 26 seconds.
So can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Is this the halo mass? Because the halo.
It's okay, yeah. This is the halo mass you would need to get a collapse.
The form stars by this redshift.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we can start by asking what happens if we just include exotic heating. So for right now, we're ignoring ionizations and the UV radiation that can cause photodissociation. So if we just consider exotic heating, what we get instead is this red line here. So this jives with our intuition. You're adding extra heat. You're making it harder for these stars to collapse. So this threshold should be raised. Makes sense. Now, if we just consider exotic ionizations, what we get is this blue dot dashed line. So you can see now that exotic ionizations can have a pretty sizable impact on star formation, right? And so this is already quite interesting because we can see that within this one model, as we had alluded to before, there are these competing effects such that it's rather non-trivial to determine in the end what's going to win out, right? Are you going to get net heating or net cooling? So the other effect we want to include is that of radiation. And so that can come in either through photodetachment or photodissociation of the H2 itself by these so-called Lyman-Werner photons. As you can see, for this particular model, the photodetachment we find has a very small effect. It like raises the threshold slightly, but not by too much. So it's not as important. But the Lyman-Werner photons for this model can have quite an impact. What you get is this pink dashed line here, and the effect is of the same order as what you would get from heating. So again, there is some uncertainty surrounding the importance of the Lyman-Werner background due to some uncertainties in how efficiently these halos are able to self-shield themselves, right? So instead of taking our best guess at what the amount of self-shielding is, we're going to bracket this effect and either say the Lyman-Werner background doesn't matter at all, or we let the center of the halo be illuminated by the full Lyman-Werner flux. Okay, so if we account for those uncertainties and add up all these effects, then what we get is this gold band for this particular model. So as you can see, at the earliest redshifts, probably before we really expect stars to form, the effect is that this mass threshold is slightly lowered. But as we move towards later redshifts, closer to like 20, 30, 40, where we expect the first stars to start turning on, in fact, the effect for this model is that the mass threshold is raised. So we would expect to see delayed star formation for this particular dark matter model. Okay, so that's for one particular model. So one particular mass, one particular injection rate. And now you might be interested in knowing what does this effect look like across a range of different dark matter models. So this is showing the parameter space again for dark matter that can decay to E plus E minus pairs. On the y-axis here, we have the lifetime of the dark matter. And on the x-axis, we have the mass of the dark matter. So just to anchor your eyes in this parameter space, I've shown this gray contour, which represents the parameter space that is already ruled out by CMB power spectrum constraints. So what will be interesting is if we get effects to the mass threshold well outside of that gray contour. OK, so this is what we find for dark matter decaying to E plus E minus. This is the effect on the mass threshold, specifically at redshift of 20, since that's approximately where we expect cosmic dawn to occur. Wherever you see these red contours, what happens is we're getting delayed star formation. And wherever you get these blue contours, that's where we're getting net cooling. And we expect stars to start forming a little bit earlier. So if you start with the smallest lifetimes, in other words, the largest injection rates, what we find is that this exotic heating tends to dominate, tends to be the largest effect. And so you get this whole swath of red parameter space here, where we would expect to get later star formation. But what's interesting is as you move to longer lifetimes, so you're injecting relatively less and less energy at any given time, this effect doesn't monotonically go to zero. For this particular channel, what's quite interesting is we find this whole band of parameter space where, in fact, the effect is this net cooling. We've lowered the mass threshold and made it easier to form stars. So that's pretty cool. So what's happening here is as you're dialing down the injection rate, you're lowering both the exotic heating and the exotic ionization. And we find that there comes to be some point where the exotic heating doesn't matter anymore, but the exotic ionization still has a significant effect on the halo. And so that's why you get this whole blue band here. Another cool thing is that although a lot of this red parameter space is ruled out by the CMB constraints, you still have some points where you can get, where exotic heating is still allowed, although maybe not by indirect detection constraints, which are shown in this green dot dashed line. But outside of both the CMB and indirect detection constraints, we still get a significant swath of parameter space where we find this net cooling effect. And so there could still be a significant impact on the formation of the earliest stars in our universe. Let's see what else. I should also mention that this plot was calculated assuming very efficient self-shielding of these halos. So we ignored the effect of the Lyman-Werner background on star formation. But I'll show you results in a minute or so that shows what happens once you include the Lyman-Werner background. OK, but this was for redshift of 20. I can go ahead and sorry. What was that?
Yeah, so is it here?
Islands?
Mm-hmm. Like,
like down here?
No. Like, can you go back two figures?
Two figures. Here.
Yeah. So you say, below, my question is,
when you say island, do you mean like isolated in redshifts or?
Let's say like at some redshifts, a very small halo mass and star formation.
Very small halo mass. Good. So you're saying like if like this.
Low redshift. Yeah. So is it like always like it's gray, like all the way to some point, or like I can have islands on
my inside? I think I'm still maybe not quite understanding your question. You're asking at low redshifts.
Yeah. Is it always going to be one threshold, or like it could be like there is a bench of a halo mass?
Oh, I see what you mean.
There are a minimum and a maximum
on that. I see. I think people expect it to be more like a threshold. I'm not aware of any effects that could cause just a window of halo masses to allow for star formation. Because as you go to, let's say, we expect star formation to be effective above a certain threshold. As you go to higher and higher masses, what that means is when the halo virial.
I'm asking about halo masses going down.
Oh.
I'm in the middle where I
Yeah, so as you go to lower and lower masses, once the halos virialize, they'll virialize at a much smaller temperature. And usually at such low temperatures, cooling, counterintuitively, cooling is less efficient.
So it's not a very sharp one, but it is like very just a transition.
Okay, sure. We have 15 minutes of discussion time, so good. So I was just saying, so although this plot is for redshift of 20, we can recalculate it for any redshift we're interested in. Generally, what we find is that the shape of the contours stays pretty much the same, but their height in the space and their depth tends to change with redshift. But again, since 20 to 30-ish is around where we expect the first stars to turn on, that's what we're going to focus on. So this was for efficient self-shielding. Now what happens if I allow for the effect of Lyman-Werner photons? So this is what happens if I say the halos are terrible at self-shielding and they feel the full brunt of this Lyman-Werner radiation. So as you can see, these red contours have spread out a little bit. That makes sense because allowing this Lyman-Werner background to have effect dissociates the H2, makes it harder to cool. So we're going to get more parameter space where the effect is net heating. And then also the depth of these blue contours is somewhat reduced, as you can see. Like this valley here has become a bit shallower. But we still see that there is can be a significant impact on star formation in these regions, even when we include self-shielding. So that's good because it means that these models are interesting to study, regardless of our assumptions on how much these halos can self-shield.
Is that gap real?
Which gap? This one? I would believe there's maybe a point here. I would have to double check. It could be interpolation because we did, I think, like a grid of maybe like 20 to like 20 lifetimes and 20 masses, but I would have to check exactly where the values lie.
I would expect the structure to really just be smooth across the...
Oh, yeah, so you're talking about these random islands. Yeah, those could be interpolation effects. We used a pretty coarse grid of lifetimes and masses, yeah. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I want to talk about how would we actually look for such a change to the mass threshold for star formation. So the probe that we turned to is 21 centimeter cosmology. So just a two-line review, 21 centimeter cosmology refers to telescopes looking for the hyperfine transition of neutral hydrogen. This is really great for studying the era of the epoch of reionization as well as cosmic dawn because we have a lot of neutral hydrogen around at this time. So if we look at what the 21 centimeter signal is like as a function of redshift, here we have the global signal, the brightness temperature of the 21 centimeter signal. You can see that there are a lot of features as a function of redshift, these peaks and troughs. And the location of these peaks and troughs depends on events such as when did the first stars and galaxies turn on. So then if we're messing with the mass threshold and thereby changing the timing of early star formation, we should also probably be affecting where these features appear. So using Julian's ZEUS21 code, we studied exactly what the change to that mass threshold would do to these signals. So on the left here, we have the global signal, the 21 centimeter brightness temperature as a function of redshift. And on the right here, we have the 21 centimeter power spectrum at a very specific wave number, k of 0.2 inverse megaparsecs, this also as a function of redshift. So the black line here shows the default model within ZEUS21. And then these red and blue bands, show you what happens if we throw in the models that were demarcated on this plot by the star and this dot. So we chose these models because they show opposite effects on star formation. OK, so and then again, the band here shows the uncertainty due to the self-shielding effects. But even within these uncertainties, you can see that what these models do is they vary the location of this peak by about 1 to 2 in redshift. And so that means if experiments such as HERA make a measurement of this power spectrum across redshift, then maybe it could tell us a little bit more about when stars turned on, and thus tell us a little bit more, maybe, about what the nature of dark matter is. But before we say anything more quantitative about how well exactly future experiments would do, we're going to have to refine this calculation a bit and maybe turn to hydrodynamical simulations, for example. So those are some follow-up directions that we are thinking about. Okay, so that pretty much brings me to the end of my talk. Just to summarize, exotic energy injection is a relatively general feature of many dark matter models. We've already heard about annihilation. We've talked a bit about primordial black holes, and here I've focused on decay. What's interesting is that exotic heating, ionization, and radiation can all have competing effects on star formation, and so it's relatively non-trivial to determine whether or not models can accelerate or delay star formation. And so what we've done is to try to scan across the parameter space to determine which models have the biggest effect and what direction is the effect, and also showed that these signals are potentially detectable in upcoming 21 centimeter data. So some future directions that we've thought about. It would be good to maybe investigate what is the degeneracy of these changes to the 21 centimeter signal with other astrophysical parameters. It'll be interesting to run more detailed simulations of what star formation looks like with this kind of exotic energy injection. And together with Ben Lehman and some collaborators at Tel Aviv University, we've been looking at first black hole formation along the lines of what Flip and Aaron were talking about earlier. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting directions to go, and I'm happy to chat with you about any of these today and tomorrow. Thank you.
Two things. One is maybe a refinement on what I was asking earlier. So there is some structure in the absorption, yeah, for example, in the just IgM, whether it's transparent or not, to injected energy that might show up as features along that axis. So,
as features you mentioned, like at just seven numbers, there's a trial, right? Like, I think
that
might be real.
I think so.
There's a transparency window.
That's a transparency window, and then at some point you hit the pair production.
Yeah.
And the structure is a function of redshift and energy.
The other,
I don't know if it's a question, but the 21 centimeter power spectrum, just like the astrophysical uncertainties on that, are nuts.
So what this was meant to show was not necessarily that we will be able to use this to constrain dark matter, but to start off with, we wanted to ask how big is the effect that dark matter can have, right? Because if it turned out that, you know, the shift was like, I don't know, like really tiny in redshift, then it probably wouldn't be worth looking at this at all in 21 seconds.
Yeah. There's things like just the efficiency of x-rays and virial temperature of your clothes, like everything that's going on in just regular reionization. Gets turned into an effective parameter that goes into time on centimeter pass, and you don't really know what that is.
Yeah.
So I get the impression it's going to be really hard to disentangle.
Yeah.
What you might be able to do is look for correlations as a function of redshift and power of these different effects and try to pull them apart in that way.
Correlations, sorry, say that again, correlations in.
So if you look at the effect of these versus the effect of, say, changing x-ray efficiency. From regular star formation, and seeing if you can break, if there are degeneracies that you can break.
Yeah. Cross correlations between slightly different parts.
Like the space of possible parameters, it's like this green thing here. And that's just the astrophysical parameters.
Sorry, what's on the x and y axis there?
So this is redshift and power spectrum.
So oh, I see. Yeah. So again, it could be. It is definitely difficult. It could be the case that once we look at the degeneracy of this effect by varying with other astrophysical parameters, it will be much harder to detect such a shift due to dark matter. But I would say the optimistic take is that dark matter can still have a, you know, potentially important impact.
Yeah.
Questions.
interested when you were at Perimeter before. But have you thought about HD?
HD?
Yeah.
So we only considered the four reactions that I put up just because those seem to be the most important ones for determining the final H2 abundance. From what I saw in the literature, the other reactions have probably less than like a 10% effect on the final H2 abundance.
Well, HD can lead to cooling in some of the low mass halos that wouldn't cool by H2 cooling alone.
Oh, the HD itself. Oh, that's interesting. We only considered like the simplest chemical network that we could include. You're saying for these, like in this parameter space, maybe HD could also, or like in some of these other models, HD could have an impact post cooling.
Like your standard model critical should be maybe a little bit different.
I see. I see. That could be interesting to include. My guess is that the qualitative effects would still be, like the size of the impact of dark matter would still be similar, even if we included that, but maybe we could look more into that, for sure.
It's more effective on specifically the small halos, that could be quite interesting if you're sort of bumping up, because there's a lot of small halos.
Yeah.
Roughly what temperature with HD?
Temperature, like it forms sufficiently, like around 500 Kelvin or something. Mm-hmm. You want is like a relatively long period of time where you're hanging around that temperature. But why is HD good? It's actually a much stronger coolant than H2 because it does have a permanent dipole moment, so it can cool down to like tens of Kelvin. So you don't have that much deuterium, but you only need a little bit of HD to compete with H2. Well, that's D over A, right? I guess that's a fragment issue.
So, is the topology something measurable? The topology of the radiation?
The topology of, are you saying like the spectrum of radiation that we get?
The power spectrum question, I guess, for the scales involved here. We have the angular scales.
You're asking if.
Probably too small.
Just wondering, does the spatial pattern change?
Yeah, I mean, I think what this is telling us is that the fluctuations on certain scales are changing as a result. So this would change the spatial pattern. Yeah.
Some fixed resonance scale. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I guess I just don't know whether what angular scales that corresponds to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I suppose we could have made another plot of this power spectrum as a function of k at a specific redshift instead. We looked at two particular wave numbers, and I think the two wave numbers we looked at were at like 0.2 and 0.5 inverse megaparsecs, and at least the effect was similar. I would guess that as you move to larger scales which are less affected by the details of star formation, you would see less of an effect, and maybe vice versa. Yeah.
And for reference, 0.2 is roughly the best spin you have. It's a fairly large scale. You see the average effect of these spins. You're not seeing individual. Good idea, you have to zoom in to actually individual sources, but I don't have much hope
to do that. Okay, so you don't think you can really resolve. Resolve
the scale of your sense of these regions. You will see their effect overall, but not individual sources.
Mm-hmm.
because those, you know, like, we only saw that in
the this is sort of you have to build those
or do other things like we have other observables that they are. But here, yeah, like, if you think of 21 centimeter average 40 as like 1 meter wavelength, you have to do super really small scale interferometry, that's very far away. Then you have to be correct. So we'll measure large scales first.
Any other final questions? Okay, let's thank Wentz again.